Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast, sponsored by Bell, a Textron company. I'm your host, Bagha Maradian, joining you this week from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, on the sidelines of the Halifax International Security Forum up here. A lot of things going on, and we're going to be talking about the latest in Brexit, the latest with the 737 in the wake of the Indonesian jetliners crash, Lockheed Saab, and much more. Joining us to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Barbara.
Richard Abalafia of the Teal Group Consultancy, one of the world's leading aviation experts. Richard, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Vago.
And Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London. Sash, thanks for joining us amidst the chaos that's going on there at the moment.
Thank you, Vago.
So not to put too fine a point on it, where do we stand with Brexit and what are its implications for the business community? Theresa May struck a deal with European leaders, but then lost support from many of her conservatives. This is a rapidly changing scenario. To our listeners, by the time you hear this, things may have changed a little bit, but bring us up to speed on where we are and what it means for defense and aerospace.
Okay, Vago, anybody who tells you that they know what's going on is lying, or they're just kidding themselves, but, you know, whatever. Last week, it politically was mayhem. The fascinating thing was that the mayhem was predominantly in the Conservative government, because the Labour opposition is incapable of coming up with a single coherent line of opposition concerning Brexit. But Theresa May presented a draft proposal which had been agreed with the European Commission. There were multiple resignations from her cabinet, and there is still a group of pretty senior ministers inside the cabinet who are dedicated to fighting against this proposal. It's very, very unlikely to make it through Parliament. The risk of a no confidence vote in Theresa May, and hence her losing the premiership, is high. The risk that the UK just crashes out of the EU is extremely high. It's a mess. This is of the scale of Suez in 1956 in terms of a major mess in the UK's relations with the rest of the world, but particularly with the EU. What I would point to that happened this week, which got much less press coverage in the UK than it probably should have done, was that Emmanuel Macron, President of France, and Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, both called for the formation of a European army. And they used as part of the reason for this the proposed withdrawal from the by the US from the INF, Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. There are several implications of this. One is that Macron and Merkel calling for a European army just feeds red meat and then some to the Brexiteers, the people who want a hard Brexit, who want the UK out of Europe at any cost. It is astonishingly bad timing, and it really feeds the flames in no uncertain term. The other issue, I think, is that, you know, what we're seeing here is the start of a breakup of NATO, that European nations, continental European nations, do not seem to feel that they can trust the US commitment to the continent, or certainly not trust it in the way they have done in the past. They are trying to prepare structures that would supplant a US-led NATO. This, of course, may end up weakening any ties with the UK as well, where Canada comes into that, heaven knows where. But I think that, you know, the call for a European army this week by both Macron and Merkel, who arguably are the two statesmen that matter in Europe, was an astonishing piece of timing. You can see why they're frustrated by the US withdrawal from INF, but it just makes, you know, it takes us from bad to awful.
And do you think that, who capitalizes on this, right? Does Labour end up
Labour is incapable of capitalizing on this, because Labour has as many divisions concerning Brexit as the Conservatives does. The astonishing thing is how weak Labour has been in the whole Brexit thing. But the Conservatives are capable of tearing themselves to pieces all by their own.
Yes. It's an extraordinary situation, and I agree that the timing for the European Army initiative, which first started with Macron as a suggestion, and then sort of getting some more meat, Angela Merkel at first a little bit half-hearted, saying eventually, whereas we've seen a little bit of a deeper take on it, something that clearly we've got to pay attention to. Ron, are markets at all responding? I mean, what's sort of New York's take on what's going on in London?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at global markets in general, right? I mean, you've seen increased volatility over several issues, right? I mean, there's a growing concern that we're starting to see the top in the current business cycle, and then uncertainties like Brexit or other things just kind of add fuel to that fire, right? So, you know, we've seen, you know, multiple companies across different segments start to take down their earnings outlooks, and that, you know, that worries folks. And then when you start dealing with things like, you know, the friction caused by, you know, the trade with China and the U.S., the Brexit reforms and all that, it just kind of adds to the market's worries about, yeah, maybe we are starting to see, you know, growth peaking.
Oh, we should call it the Epstein Index, because, you know, you've so consistently talked about it on virtually every episode of the show in terms of watching volatility. Let me go back to you really quickly, Sash. Are companies were threatening and in some cases very quietly triggering plans to gird for a hard Brexit? Are we seeing any activity or companies being more vocal about what they're going to have to do? Because I got to tell you something. The end of March is right around the corner. And from a corporate standpoint, perilously little time to position yourself properly, not to get hurt.
Look, Vargy, if you haven't done this already, you're too late. Companies have been planning Brexit strategies for the last 2 years. But, you know, the network industries, the industries that have a supply chain across Europe and across the world, it is incapable of planning for a hard Brexit, because you cannot, take the case of Airbus. Airbus gets its wings and in some cases parts of, you know, engines, landing gear from the UK. You couldn't in 2 years replace that with sourcing from within Europe. So, you know, in the event of a hard Brexit, Airbus is going to have real challenges, as are all the automakers. The people who've been making the most coherent plans have tended to be the financial services companies, who've been putting small offices into other parts of Europe for the last 2 years and will continue to do so. But in the last week, companies have been very quiet.
Richard, from an elasticity standpoint, how does this play out, right? I'm sure that you've talked to some companies about what they're going to do to ensure, you know, at a time that we're at an all-time historic boom cycle where, you know, these companies can't build jets fast enough. This injects quite a lot of uncertainty in a supply chain that is already stretched to the max.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The best you can do, of course, is stockpile components, try to make contingency plans, and make the best of it, really. I mean, I think the real damage right now is being done to the alignment that needs to happen for next generation military and civil aircraft. Basically, now is the time to start planning for, say, a new pan-European fighter or a series of fighters or a series of combat vehicles of all sorts, systems of systems. And that's basically impossible until this mess gets resolved.
Let's shift gears. Let's go to the 737 issue. You know, the questions after that Lion Air flight went down of the new 787 MAX 8 was a brand new airplane, you know, 800 hours on the clock. You know, there were some concerns, right? 737 early, the earlier versions of the jet did have a problem where some accidents, some crashes were attributed to a design flaw. There were some folks who looked at that and said, well, you know, it's unlikely, you know, the bugs have been worked out of this airplane. Richard, bring us up to speed on what the latest concern is by pilots, that there could be at least a training issue that may be problematic for aviators that are unfamiliar with the type.
Yeah, I think that's the important thing to remember here. Everyone gets skittish because this is easily Boeing's biggest program now and pretty much ever in the history of the company. So from a revenue standpoint, people get skittish when you start talking about design flaws, but this is not going to be a hardware issue. This might be an easy software fix, but more importantly, I think there's going to be a healthy debate about the level of automation of, you know, cockpit crew resource management and things like that. Basically, it there's a lot of pushback from the pilots about this being introduced, this system, the MCAS system being introduced with or without their knowledge. That seems to be a little bit unresolved at this point.
And tell our audience what the MCAS system is, right? Give us sort of the 15-second what it is we're talking about.
Sure. Basically, it's a sort of automated no pilot input system that in the event of a angle of attack being indicating a stall, it pushes the nose down using, of course, the stabilizers. And it basically doesn't, the debate seems to be about whether or not the pilots were told about the system, which for a Boeing product has a very high level of automation and by some accounts, a fairly complicated level of manual override required. So I think there's a whole bunch of debates, but none of them are actually germane to the design of the aircraft or its major systems. This is a software issue. It's a training issue. This is going to get resolved pretty quickly.
Ron, you're an airplanes guy with a PhD in aerodynamics and know more about airplanes than just about anybody else I know. No offense, Richard. No offense, Sash. We're airplane guys, but we don't know how to design them, nor do we look at an intake and go, wow. Talk to us a little bit about what this means and whether this is going to be an easy fix and what the implications are for Boeing. Anytime you have a loss of an airplane that is not down to human factors, it starts to become problematic for the manufacturer.
So everything Richard said, I agree with 100%, right? So, but when you think about what's going on here, you know, why does this quote unquote MCAS system exists, this maneuvering characteristics augmentation system, that's what they call it. Well, they had to shift the center of gravity of the airplane around because they were dealing with different size engines and, just that happens, right? I mean, you put bigger engines on that are heavier, the center of gravity moves around. So that's part of the reason the system got put on the airplane. Per Richard's point, you know, per what we've, you know, read, heard publicly, it's unclear how much, you know, the pilots were trained on this system. The FAA certified the system clearly. There's a version of the manuals for the airplanes for the 737 that had to get certified by the FAA. In terms of, you know, what Boeing told the airlines, what the airlines did with it, and kind of that's a big open question. I think that the thing to me that kind of jumps out is over the years, you've always heard, you know, the difference between, you know, the Boeing product and the Airbus product is with the Boeing product, the pilot has the ultimate authority over the airplane in the end, right? I mean, the pilot flies the plane and the computer doesn't fly the plane, right? And that was, you know, for years, you remember, I mean, that was sort of a sticking point between the two companies. Well, in this case, it kind of seemed like the computer flew the airplane, right? So it gets back to the point, you know, how do you shut this thing off, automation, so on and so forth. That maybe the one point where I disagree with Richard a little bit, these things always take longer to figure out and get an ultimate conclusion than you hope, right? So, I mean, if this can get cleared up in a year, that would be great, but it's going to take a while. And there'll probably be some recommendations in terms of pilot training and so on and so forth. But however, that being said, remember all this happened because of a chain of events, right? I mean, you know, an angle of attack indicator or an airspeed indicator, you suggested the airplane was in a stall, the airplane did what it was supposed to in a stall configuration. However, it did it at a really low altitude and the pilots didn't apparently know what the airplane was doing, right? So, you know, as always with these things, there's a whole chain of events. And it's, right?
Right. Well, look, any accident, any crash is not one thing. But what are the potential financial implications? What has the impact been on the stock at this point?
Yeah, it's actually weighed surprisingly heavy on the stock. We've seen the stock sell off a bit on it, right? I mean, remember, the stock has been, you know, an absolute animal over the last about 2 years, and it's given back a little bit on this. And I think it's just people trying to get their head around it. Like, you know, what's it mean? It's, you know, this is when you think about precedent and airplane accidents, luckily, you know, wonderfully, we just haven't had that many, right? I mean, in recent decade. And B, and this one feels like it's a little different. So I think people are trying to get their heads around it. Ultimately, right? And I've heard things like, you know, investors have called me and said, is this like the Dieselgate thing at Volkswagen? No, clearly not. I mean, they're not trying to hide anything. This is all certified and so on and so forth. Nobody wants an airplane to crash. The intent of this, there was no bad deed going on, clearly, right? So, what's the financial implication? Well, there could be, could be, depending on how it comes out, some culpability that goes back to Boeing, maybe, maybe not. And I'm certain they have a level of, you know, liability insurance to cover it. So in the end, probably doesn't matter that much financially. And then demand for the airplanes, right, 737s and, you know, A320s right now is huge, right? So, you know, is it going to slow down deliveries? Probably not. Could it, you know, it change how pilots are trained? Maybe, so on and so forth. But ultimately, you know, the financial impact on the company probably isn't all that material.
Sash, do you have anything to add, or do you want to talk about the investor meeting that you went, that Saab's investor meeting?
Saab had an investor meeting this week. It's one of these very strange European companies that is very small, you know, under $5 billion of market value, but it has this complete panorama of defense capabilities, combat aircraft, advanced airborne early warning, aircraft, submarines, weapons, missiles, and so forth. And I think what was very interesting about this whole meeting, apart from the fact that clearly, you know, the company is in the midst of trying to raise about 6 billion crowns, so about 500, 600 million dollars of new equity, is the degree to which they made some very interesting comments about the Boeing TX program, where they are the major partner to Boeing. They very much dismissed the idea that because Boeing has taken a charge on TX, they might have to as well. They said, you know, that was Boeing's business, but they're going to make good money based on the contract they have with Boeing. Now, you know, I think some people are going to be quite cautious about that, but it does suggest that the two companies have got different cost bases, and the two companies have got very, very different expectations of how they can make money out of the TX program at the current price. I think the other thing that really interested me was that there, you know, Saab are implicitly accepting some really punchy forecasts for TX, which personally I think is verging on irresponsible. There is there's been a forecast out there that they say Boeing is happy with of 2,600 TXs being sold over the lifetime of the program. Saab said they'd be very happy with 2,000. Well, guys, you know, there's only 351 on order at the moment. 2,000 TXs would be more than the total number, or be the same as the total number of T-38s and BAE Hawks ever built. I just can't see the replacement market for a very advanced jet trainer reaching the level of the two most successful jet trainers in history. And it does worry me that expectations management on TX is still, you know, it's still not stable. It's still not right.
Any other challenges across the piece? A26 development is going on. That's the new submarine. The company has been very bullish about progress.
I was very interested about A26. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. I mean, they actually took us around the Karlskrona, the Kockums yard there, and they've got big segments of A26 in build. What I thought was most interesting about that is that they've been doing a big upgrade of the predecessor submarine, the Gotland class. They've been fitting it with air-independent propulsion, a lot of new sensors, weapons, systems, and they're effectively using the Gotland submarine to debug a huge amount of the A26 systems. So by the time they start putting people onto an A26, some of these submariners will have been working with exactly that equipment at sea in a working submarine for 2-3 years beforehand. And the integration should be relatively less of a hurdle for them. I thought that was a really interesting story there. One final thing. We just had a look at the Visby class corvettes again. And if you want to see what a literal combat ship looked like when it was designed 15 years ago and it still looks great today, the Visbys are a fantastic design. Under 1,000 tons, the same armament as a US LCS, but with 8 really big surface-to-surface anti-ship missiles, RBS-15s. Very, very stealthy in design. And it makes me wonder if the Swedes can do that, and if the Swedes could do that at the turn of the century, why is it that the LCS program went through this sort of tortuous, you know, leader-follower twin design program where they still haven't debugged the surface anti-surface warfare, anti-submarine warfare modules?
Excellent point. We're running very, very short on time. Two very quick questions. Richard, Give us your take on what Sash said regarding the market outlook and prospects for the TX jet. Do you disagree with Saab's forecast and the Boeing forecast by extension?
I agree completely with what Sash said. As a matter of fact, I think Sash was being a bit generous. The truth is, of the 1,100 T-38s built, very few were paid for by export customers. I think approximately zero. Most were given away under FMF. The rest were cascaded down used from the U.S. Air Force after they went through 700 or 800 of them. The Hawks, yes, a bunch of those were actually sold, but 200 or so went to Britain. You know, what is the market for a high-end jet trainer that costs 20-something million and is powered by an F-404 engine? History would suggest it's a few hundred at best, being super extra optimistic. I just don't see its potential as a light combat aircraft unless they do a lot to the design. And there might be something there, another couple hundred, but really nothing like the 2000 that Saab and Boeing have discussed.
And Ron, we've got about 30 seconds. Give us a wrap on Lockheed news flow.
Yeah, so Lockheed hosted an investor day at their at the Sikorsky facility up in Stratford, Connecticut. And you know, I think there was a couple of key takeaways from the day. They gave us a nice tour of the facility, and then we spent a bunch of time talking to the corporate management, but also the Sikorsky management. I think one point they wanted to drive across was, you know, we're a better owner for this asset than United Technologies was. And one of the managers got up and I think made a really good point. He said, you know what, I gave up Otis elevators for the F-35. Okay, all right, I get that. That makes a lot of sense. And then he said, you know, we gave up, you know, carrier air conditioning for a missile system business. And so I think they got that point across. I think they're also trying to get across that there's something on the order of maybe 100 billion of opportunities for the RMS segment in which Sikorsky lives. So I think they're trying to tell investors that there's more to Lockheed than just the F-35. And then kind of walked you know, through detail on the Future Vertical Lift program, their offerings there, and so on and so forth. But I think probably the two biggest, most important points of the day were, you know, hey, this is better in our hands and it's actually going well, maybe after a little rocky start, but it's going okay now. And that there's a lot of growth opportunities here.
And anything on F-35?
Nope. The day really didn't talk about F-35. You know, the focus was on the CH-53K, all the variations of the Black Hawk, and then Future Vertical Lift.
Everybody gets 10 seconds exactly to give us what they're going to be watching over the coming week. Sash?
Key for me this week is going to be the results from Babcock International. These are the guys who do virtually all of the nuclear and surface ship refitting for the Royal Navy. They're a big operator of all fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters as well.
Ron?
Yeah, so this week in the U.S. actually will be a pretty quiet week because of the holiday, and then we roll into the market's kind of wrapping up in December. I think the key things to keep an eye on here are just the broader macro factors, not so specific aerospace and defense, but, you know, the broader economy, the business cycle, all the things that have been underlying that volatility. And maybe one point that's important is oil prices have been trending down. I mean, I think we've seen oil prices drop almost 20% in a very short period of time, and the impact that's going to have on air traffic and so on and so forth. The last air traffic read we had about a month and a half ago was global air traffic was growing 5.5%. If we continue to see air traffic kind of trending down, that's something to keep an eye on.
Any impact at all from the fiscal issues that we've been seeing? Concerns about government shutdown, et cetera, moving no needles at this point?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, no, not so much, right? I mean, I think the market's just sort of, you know, digesting midterms and what all that means.
10 seconds, right. I agree. It's oil prices because the jetliner market functions, not just traffic, jetliner market functions best when fuel is between 50 and 75. If we're heading for a sustained period below 50, we're going to start to know that probably in the next few weeks. That's really interesting because, of course, the MAX and NEO, their great appeal rests upon helping airlines cope with higher fuel prices.
Guys, thanks very much for joining this week. Hope all of you have a great Thanksgiving. And to all of our listeners, hope you guys have a great Thanksgiving as well. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report. And subscribe to our weekly newsletter. And check out our interviews with Alan Pellegrini, the president and CEO of Thales North America. Bridge Colby, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Planning, now at the Center for a New American Security. And stand by for our interviews with General Michael Bodian, the Supreme Commander of Sweden's Armed Forces, and stand by for our gavel-to-gavel coverage of this 10th anniversary gathering of the Halifax International Security Forum, where our coverage was sponsored by L3 Technologies and Leonardo DRS. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report, that's at DefAero Report, and like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. Thanks again to Bell, a Textron company, for their generous sponsorship. And until we're together again, have a great week and a great Thanksgiving.